is Archbishop William Laurie of Baltimore, and you are listening to Catholic Review Radio. Catholic Review Radio is a weekly radio program and podcast hosted by Catholic Review Media, the news operation of the Archdiocese of Baltimore. We are grateful to our Catholic partners for the opportunity to bring quality Catholic programming to our listeners each week.
Welcome to Catholic Review Radio. I'm George Matisek. During the Second Vatican Council, a mysterious voice began reporting from inside the closed-door sessions, exposing tensions and calling for reform. That voice belonged to Xavier Rin, the pseudonym of Father Francis Xavier Murphy, a Redemptorist priest who risked everything to write anonymously about the Council's inner workings. Today, we're joined by Richard A. Zamuda, author of a new historical novel, The Mole of Vatican Council II, which brings Father Murphy's remarkable story to life. Zamuda, a parishioner of the Redemptorist Parish of St. Mary's in Annapolis, draws on personal letters, diaries, and secret Vatican files to explore why Father Murphy wrote, what he risked, and how his reporting still echoes in today's church. Richard, thanks so much for being here on Catholic Review Radio.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So as we mentioned, you're a parishioner of St. Mary in Annapolis, where Father Murphy served for 20 years or so. How did you first come to know him?
Well, I was a parishioner for years, and all of a sudden I got a phone call from Father Murphy himself. It was toward the end of his life, early 80s. He was suffering from cancer and Parkinson's, but he needed help writing a foreword to a book that he wrote, Vatican Council II, at the 50th anniversary edition. So he asked if I would help him. He knew I was a teacher of literature at the high school level, as well as a freelance writer. So he'd heard of me somehow, called me up, invited me over and asked me to read the book, which I did, and then to write the foreword, which I did. And it went out for the 50th anniversary of Vatican II and the book itself. That worked out well. But then I said, Father, there's an incredible personal story behind here, not just your detailed reporting of Vatican II, but your role in it. And it took him 45 years to really come out of the catacombs, is the way he referred to it, to say that he was indeed Xavier Rin, who wrote the articles for The New Yorker. And I said, Father, let me help you pull your story together. Turned out to be a lot more of a project than I originally anticipated. The 50th anniversary book went well. But then I sat down with him. He gave me access to all of his personal files, all of his manuscripts, all the detailed histories that had been written about him, plus a ton of personal correspondence. I started working on it in the summers, in between teaching semesters. And then toward the end of his life, he was invited to New York to get a Lifetime Achievement Award for the New York Literature Society of Arts. I accompanied him to that, came back, started working on the novel, and then he was passing away, and he called me in the hospital literally the day before he died. He said, Richard, took my hand and said, please write my story. Of course, I said yes, but talk about Catholic guilt. Goodness gracious. It took me about 15 more years thereafter to pull it all together. I retired 2 years ago, finally had the time, took two trips to Rome to research the book. But also when I was in Rome, I came across secret files that were provided to me that they kept on Father Murphy because of what he did in Vatican II. They tried for years to figure out who the mole was, who was secretly sending articles to the New Yorker. Finally, at the end of Vatican II, these certain cardinals found out who he was. They tried to pin him down, but he came under the protection of a certain new pope called Paul VI, and he was able to continue writing articles until then. Publicly, inside the Curia, they knew who he was. Outside the Curia, they had no idea until toward the end of his life. It was fascinating. So I said, Father, it's a way for me to not only let Catholics know how Vatican II unfolded, but also to tell your remarkable story as part of that.
You detail this very well in your book, but could you explain for our listeners how this Redemptorist priest wound up in Rome and how he wound up at the Second Vatican Council with such tremendous access to say what was going on with the turmoil of the council?
Yep. A lot of luck and a lot of ambition. Father Murphy was brilliant, but he also had ambition. And he'd gone to Rome probably 4 years, 5 years prior to that, just to do some research at the Redemptorist Academy Alfonziana there. And then he heard that they needed a researcher for news as the to cover the Italian elections. He pursued it, he got it, and just by luck, he was posted in Rome at when the elevation of John the 23rd took place. He was in the piazza there. And then there was a Bishop Willinger from California who 2 years later, when John the 23rd called Vatican II, he was still there. Willinger could not access all of the events because of his health. He asked Father Murphy to do it for him. And so Father Murphy got the golden pass that all the cardinals had. He had access to everything, conversations in elevators, conversations in coffee shops, meetings. And he literally wrote it all down. And he was alarmed at a small group of extremely conservative cardinals were determined to destroy Vatican II before it started and then to hinder it continuing. And he was passionate about letting the truth out. And it was basically him versus the Curia for 4 years. And Father Murphy succeeded.
You spend a lot of time in your book talking about the dangers associated with exposing what he saw. There was an oath of secrecy at the council, and he obviously violated that oath. Could you talk about why he chose to do that and what those consequences would have been for violating that oath?
Absolutely. He was an imperfect hero, if you will, who did something truly historic. There's a very human side to Father Murphy, which he probably didn't anticipate me including in his life story. He was looking more for the academic side. But the more I learned about him and the more I learned that others knew about him, I had to pull that together for a complete story. They did take a vow of secrecy, and he violated that. There's no question about it. But he looked for the greater good, if you will. And as the articles, there's about more than a dozen of them came through the New Yorker over the period of 4 years. As these articles came out, it emboldened the majority of the cardinals and bishops who were attending to speak up, because Cardinal Ottaviani and a number of other cardinals in the Curia had a stranglehold basically on church doctrine, on church power, and no one dared to confront them. Prior popes, Pius the 11th, Pius the 12th, had tried and did not succeed. See, John the 23rd, gosh, he was in his late 70s, and they thought he was just going to be a caretaker pope. Little did they realize that he had the gumption to take them on, but he didn't succeed. And people don't realize Vatican Council II took place over a 4 year period. It wasn't until the 4th year that Paul the 6th finally had enough progressive cardinals on his side to take on Cardinal Ottaviani. And as you'll see in the book, the first 3 years, not much happened. But by the 4th year, they were emboldened. And it was all, I can't say it was all due, but in a good degree, was due to the effort of Father Murphy to break his vow and to expose what was happening inside the Vatican walls. And he eventually succeeded.
Could he have faced excommunication for what he did if it was uncovered?
That was specifically mentioned to him. Yes, it was. And there was a bishop in the Holy Office, which was the successor to the Holy Inquisition of all things, who was tasked by Cardinal Ottaviani to expose Father Murphy. He eventually did, and he was confronted to face an excommunication. But with a little bit of sleight of hand, if you will, they asked Father Murphy if he was Xavier Wren, and he said no. He didn't lie, but he didn't really tell the truth. He sort of squirreled his way through that. And in this one remarkable moment, Parente said something about Pope Pius III, that he was crazy in the head. And you don't say that about popes. Father Murphy said, write that down. And in a mini panic, Parente left the room before the excommunication could have taken place. And Father Murphy goes, oh my gosh, I made it through that. But what it did, it emboldened him to therefore get more detail and to continue writing. He goes, what do I have to lose anymore? And sure enough, he was protected from further excommunication threats for the last year of the Vatican Council II, and therefore he made it past it. Yes.
In your book, you say that the Pope found out about this and also relayed that he would have some consequences from the Redemptor superiors. Did that ever happen? Did he face any retribution from his superiors in the Redemptorist?
Well, it's interesting. What you saw in the book were the actual letters that were written by Ottaviani. to go. He said he wanted to go to the Pope, but he first went to the head of the Redemptorist Order. And a cardinal who was running Vatican II at the time said, there's got to be consequences for what is taking place. This has got to stop. They did not take action, which infuriated Cardinal Ottaviani that the Redemptorist Order would not take action. But they knew what was going on in the overall Vatican Council. And I guess by their passiveness, their lack of action, they protected him. Did it get up to the Pope? Yes, indeed, it did. He had two meetings with the Pope, which he had mentioned to me verbally, and I sort of alluded to in the writing. But the Redemptorist did not take action. The Pope did not take action against him. Because of that, Cardinal Ottaviani and others in the Curia did not take action against him as well.
So in choosing the pseudonym, it would seem that it wouldn't be too difficult to figure out because he chose his middle name and his mother's maiden name, Xavier Rin. Was he trying to be discovered or
He was a knucklehead. He
like
was. He
what?
did it in a panic. I shouldn't call Father Murphy a knucklehead. I wrote a book about the gentleman. But it's the worst pseudonym in the world. He did it in a quick moment. He was meeting with this literary agent, John Chapin, and Chapin said, "You took a vow of secrecy." He goes, "Yes. How are you going to protect yourself?" He just spit it out. And it's too late. Then it was published in that first article of the New Yorker, and it was too late to pull it back. It's surprising it took 3 years for the Curia to find out who he was, but they were looking for cardinals. Then they were looking for bishops, and there were 2,500 attendees there. So they focused on the American delegation eventually. And once they did, they just looked for all the other Americans who were there, and then it was just a matter of time. But no, it was a terrible, terrible pseudonym.
Well, our guest today is Richard A. Zamuda, and we're talking about his new book. It's called The Mole of Vatican Council II: The True Story of Xavier Rin. We're going to take a little break, and when we come back, we'll continue our conversation. You're listening to Catholic Review Radio. I'm George Matisek. We'll be back in a moment.
News from the Archdiocese of Baltimore and around the world. A Fells Point man is still in jail following a car crash that damaged the entrance of the Esperanza Center in the early hours of July 20th. Nabor Avila Solano, 24, was issued citations for driving under the influence, driving while impaired and reckless driving, and negligent driving, said Baltimore Police spokeswoman Nikki Fenoy. He was being held without bail, according to the state's attorney's office. A trial is scheduled for August 5th. Our repairs are underway, services have not been interrupted, and we are thankful that no one was injured in this crash, said Andy Wayne, spokesman for Catholic Charities, which operates the Esperanza Center. The Esperanza Center has been a program of Catholic Charities since the 1980s. The center offers a range of services to immigrants, handling more than 5,000 inquiries a year. At the Vatican, the relics of two saints-to-be, Blesseds Pier Giorgio Frassati and Carlo Acutis, will be in Rome for veneration during the Jubilee of Youth, July 28th to August 3rd. The Church of San Marcello al Corso will become a Blessed Carlo Acutis Center to host talks, prayer, masses, and the veneration of the first-class pericardium relic of the young blessed, it said. Visitors will also be invited to write their prayer intentions on cards, which will be taken to his tomb in Assisi, Italy, according to Catholic Christian Outreach, which organized the initiative. The coffin with Blessed Frassati's body will be brought from his tomb in Turin, Italy, to Rome's Basilica of Santa Maria Sopra Minerva near the Pantheon for veneration, the website said. The initiative will include a series of talks and masses organized by the Dominican Order. Blessed Frassati was a member of the Dominican Third Order. Both blesseds will be proclaimed saints during a canonization ceremony at the Vatican September 7th. For more, visit CatholicReview.org. From the newsroom of the Catholic Review, I'm Christopher Gunty.
This is Archbishop William Laurie of Baltimore, and you are listening to Catholic Review Radio.
Welcome back to Catholic Review Radio. I'm George Matisek. Our guest today is Richard A. Zamuda, and we're talking about his new book, The Mole of Vatican Council II, The True Story of Xavier Rin. Richard, why did Xavier Rin, Father Murphy's writings, cause such a sensation around the world?
Because no one prior to that point had really written an exposé, if you will, about what takes place inside the Vatican. It was controversial even for the New Yorker to pick it up. It was gutsy of Father Murphy to choose the New Yorker in its own right, just because of the level of the New Yorker's, literary bent, if you will. But they accepted it, and it was a risk for them as well. They didn't have as many lawsuits and stuff as we're finding today. But no one had written an inside, I guess you could call it, scandalous article about what went on in the Vatican. And what's remarkable about that is everything he wrote was true. Every quote that was in the New Yorker articles was true. They couldn't dismiss it. It was written in fact, and Father Murphy just had the guts to put it out to address the world. And in the Curia and the Vatican itself, they wanted everything to just be a quiet meeting, not quiet, a secretive meeting before they made these decisions. But Father Murphy realized early on that unless some truth came out, Vatican II would fail.
How close did those conservative cardinals that you mentioned come to derailing the council?
Unbelievably close. The council for the first 3 years, nothing happened. There were probably 60 or 70 schema topics that they wanted to cover. Out of those, the first year, nothing happened under Saint John the 23rd. The second year, when Paul the 6th came along, nothing happened. The third year, they finally got the Latin Mass to be in vernacular languages, which is a huge thing that, you and I go to church now, we understand what's going on. There was a major challenge with that with the conservatives because they thought Latin was the only common denominator for the global church. But even the cardinals and the bishops attending, their Latin wasn't all that good. It was silly. And that's basically all that happened in the first 3 years. So finally, Paul goes, we have to have another year. We have to get something accomplished. And during the fourth year, because of a lot of the articles which he had done and the emboldening of the cardinals and bishops attending in the fourth year, something finally happened. So the answer is they succeeded brilliantly in stalling the first 3 years. Because Pope Paul called the fourth year, they eventually succeeded. So that's how close it came.
There are moments in your book that feel like they could just be ripped out of today's headlines. You have these debates over liturgy, over language, over openness, all these kinds of things we're still talking about in the church today, all these many decades later. What lessons do you hope today's Catholics can learn from Father Murphy's story?
Well, I hope they learn about Vatican II. We're all living within the legacy of Vatican II. Pope Leo, in his first address to the conclave when they were still there, said one of his goals for his papacy is to continue the legacy of Vatican Council II. Yet so few Catholics, and non-Catholics for that matter, know what unfolded, the miracle of how it unfolded, but most importantly, what unfolded, the role of laity in all of our services, concelebration, the use of wine and the host, to be shared during services. It's not to mention having a mass said in your own language, that we're living in the legacy of all that, and so little of it is understood by Catholics. So the timing is wonderful for the 60th anniversary coming up. It is going to be in the news, and I would hope that any reader would be enlightened and understand what a miracle Vatican Council II was, and to appreciate how it unfolded.
Why did you choose to tell this story as a historical novel as opposed to a straight biography or a work of history?
That is a great question. Historical fiction, there's really a spectrum of historical fiction. There's some which is mostly fiction, and then you really move along to basically most of it's nonfiction. All of the documents, all of the quotes that took place, all of the events are historically accurate. You could go through and pinpoint every single line and say, okay, the locations are historically accurate. What I had to make up was conversations between popes and cardinals, and quite frankly, between Father Murphy and some of these other protagonists. Because I had to come up with those conversations, it had to be considered historical fiction. But quite frankly, anyone who reads this will be truly enlightened about what took place during that 4 year period. So on the spectrum of historical fiction, it's all primary source documents, either from Father Murphy or from Rome. And there's a number of other places in the United States where they gave me information about it. So it's so historically accurate, but I had to call it historical fiction for that very reason.
You knew Father Murphy well. Obviously, he entrusted you to tell his story. What was he like in person? Was he this bold figure? Was he more reserved? What was Father Murphy like as a person?
He was confident. He was outgoing. He was social. He was a partier. He loved a good time. And I just threw that through all the stories. I knew him the, probably the last 7 years of his life. So clearly he had slowed down a little bit. But he was an Irishman and he could tell a tale. And you could just picture him at a dinner party, just holding forth and just laughing. Photographic memory for names, photographic memory for events and personalities. He knew it all. He was lucid, literally, until the day he died. But he was confident. He was ambitious. He was passionate about the Catholic Church, and he was passionate about changes that had to take place in the Catholic Church. Vatican II took place during the 60s, when everything's going crazy with rebellions, revolts. And that's why the conservatives said, no, we don't bend to current trends. But the Catholic Church had to modernize. That's what aggiornamento was the word that John the 23rd used. It had to modernize to a modern world. And he was passionate about that.
Did he see himself more as a journalist, a reformer, a whistleblower? Like, how did he view himself, or like some combination of all of those things?
Actually, those are three great taglines, all three. No question. He was a whistleblower. He came across, as he told the stories, later on at the end of his life, that, oh yeah, I knew what I was doing, coming up with Xavier Rin. He was scared to death. And if he got excommunicated, it would have destroyed him. He was definitely a journalist. He would consider himself a novelist, a writer. He wrote more than 30 books. He wrote hundreds of articles. Whistleblower, without question. I don't know if that term existed back then, but I think he was probably one of the greatest whistleblowers of the modern church era, if you will. But he did it for all the right reasons. He didn't do it for money. He didn't do it for ego. He did it because he thought what was happening was wrong and he wanted to right that wrong.
One of the things you do so well in this book is tell the story of Cardinal Ottaviani and his strategy for derailing the council, which was actually quite brilliant. He kind of wanted to wait it out. Could you talk about where he was coming from?
Absolutely. He was firmly entrenched that the church does nothing wrong. No one's perfect. Yet he even the Galileo incident of all things, the church should have never apologized for that. He was furious that Pope Paul went to Pisa and apologized on behalf of the church. That's where Galileo did his experiments. He wanted nothing to change. And with a small group of about 30 powerful cardinals in the Curia really ran the Catholic Church at that point in time. And they were able to derail everything. He did not want it to take place in at the beginning. John the 23rd snuck it in. But then when the first session happened, he thought that's it, nothing of note occurred. He was surprised to set when Paul was elected. He was surprised he called it for a second year, and then Paul called it a third year. And he's going, Ottaviani's going, seriously, what more can I do with my cohort of cardinals? But they finally wore him down. And it wasn't just they wore him down. The conglomeration of 2,000 plus cardinals and bishops from around the world wanted to see change, and they wore him down. But honestly, a brilliant strategist. And he was going to wait him out because he'd been in the Curia for 30 plus years. He thought he could do it, but it didn't quite happen.
What do you think Father Murphy would make of the church today, how it's evolved from Vatican II?
He would love it. He would absolutely love it. Is there pushback? And I put that at the end of the book. There is pushback, between conservatives and progressives still to this day. But there's a reason John Paul, took his name from Pope John, Pope Paul, John Paul II, first and second, I should say. There's a reason that Francis dedicated himself to the legacy of the Second Vatican Council, and Pope Leo immediately on day one said the same thing. He would be thrilled by it. He would not be surprised by pushback. There's a pushback that masses go back into Latin and some other aspects of Catholic reform, but he would welcome it. Quite frankly, he was a fighter. And would he write an article about it? Oh my gosh, he'd have three or four, ready to go as we speak. So he would love it.
And how can listeners get a copy of your book?
Obviously available on Amazon, local booksellers. Amazon's probably the easiest place to access it. They can go directly to the publisher, ACTA Publications, if they want, and pretty much any local bookseller, they could get it.
Great. Well, our guest today has been Richard A. Zamuda, and we've been talking about his book, The Mole of Vatican Council II, The True Story of Xavier Rin. Richard, thanks so much again for being here on Catholic Review Radio.
Thank you so much, George.
For Catholic Review Radio, I'm George Matisek. Thanks for listening.
Have a burning question about the Catholic Church? Curious about faith, traditions, current issues, or ways of deepening your spiritual life? Now's your chance to ask a bishop. Call in to Catholic Review Radio and leave a recording of yourself asking a question for our special guest, Baltimore Auxiliary Bishop Adam J. Parker. Whether it's about the sacraments, church teaching, or everyday faith, no question is too big or too small. Your question may be featured on an upcoming episode of Catholic Review Radio with Bishop Parker. Dial 443-263-0230 now to ask your question. Don't miss out, your voice matters. Again, that's 443-263-0230. And be on the lookout for our special Ask a Bishop episode coming soon.
The Catholic Review is the only publication in the Archdiocese of Baltimore that covers the Catholic Church full-time. Pick up the monthly magazine at your parish or have it delivered to your home. Subscribe to our e-newsletter for twice-weekly updates. Just text CR Media to 84576. Follow the Catholic Review on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube. Read it today in print or online at CatholicReview.org. That's CatholicReview.org.
Tune in to Catholic Review Radio next week, available on WMET 1160 AM and 103.1 FM, also WSJF 92.7 FM in the Sykesville area, and WVTO 92.7 FM in Baltimore City. Check us out on SoundCloud or your favorite podcast app.
Thank you for joining us for this edition of Catholic Review Radio. As we prepare for the week ahead, let us do so in prayer together as one community of faith. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. Lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. Let us also ask the blessing and intercession of our Blessed Mother as we pray, Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with thee. Blessed art thou among women, and blessed is the fruit of thy womb, Jesus. Holy Mary, Mother of God, pray for us sinners now and at the hour of our death. Amen. May Almighty God bless us and keep us always in his love.